Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. And today on Welcome to Wandering DMs, and today we're going to be talking about henchmen, the interesting middle ground between player characters and non-player characters, where your players can expand their party with possibly new people. So, Paul, this is something that I think a couple of people have asked us to talk about, actually.
Yep.
And I think that it's an interesting case of how expectations have really changed over the years.
Okay. You think modern games don't really use henchmen very much? I take it.
Well, I'm finding it's one of the biggest places where my my younger new players of D&D have vastly different expectations than what's in the book.
Interesting.
And it's actually one place, the one place where I have personally just have to accept that they have a radically different expectation than what I would be used to, actually. So we'll probably get into that a little bit. So, you know, let me put down some past history. If I recall correctly, when you and I both went to GaryCon last year, we both separately went to sessions with Dave McGarry talking about his earliest play with Dave Arneson. You went to one of those, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if he said it with you, but one thing that he said with me is he said, of course, you know, the whole play of D&D and Dungeons is a transition from a bunch of wargaming. So Dave McGarry, you know, would hang out in Dave Arneson's basement, and they were playing war games, and they had atlases. And then one day, Arneson came down and said, let's play a new kind of game. I'm going to call it Blackmoor. And for this starting game, you, Dave McGarry, you're going to have one thief and 70 warriors.
I heard this story.
okay, that's what he, and you know, yeah. What, I had to check my notes, because initially I would have guessed it had been like 20 or 30 or 40, but according to my notes from that day, Dave said, I started with one thief and 70 warrior followers.
Nice.
So in the initial days, there was like, how are we transitioning from war games where you have thousands or hundreds, and now you only have 70?
Right. I seem to recall that's a change that is often accredited to Dave Arneson, that notion that each player controls one person rather than hundreds or thousands.
Right. And so at this particular, apparently the very first day of this, you had one unique leader character and you had some scores. You had only 70, right? And I think to begin with, like, they weren't in a party or a team. Like, everybody was kind of an individual semi-warlord, possibly competing, as we've talked about before.
Yep, that certainly jives with what I've heard about Blackmoor.
Yeah, so they have that sensibility of, wow, we have a very small, a much reduced number. So then you transition to, a couple of years later, to actual published D&D. And as usual, so I have the original D&D charisma table here.
Okay, like great.
On mine, yep. Right? Okay, yep. So there's no other ability score that has a unique table like this, right? Strength, intelligence, dexterity doesn't. There's only one ability score with a special table, and it's charisma. And as you can see here, depending on your charisma score...
Dan, I think you're blocking your own mic there.
Sorry, right. So they're calling them hirelings, and nowadays we would call them henchmen. But as you can see here, depending on your charisma score, you can have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or at charisma 18, you can have 12.
Yep.
12 of these characters who are going to be fighters or clerics or magic users who can increase in level and stuff like that. And you also have a loyalty bonus there.
Sure.
So now you're down to just single digits, probably, of 1 through 6 or 12 at the top level, and that's the primary thing that charisma gives you in the game.
Mm-hmm.
If you transition to a future point where you ignore that, now charisma becomes a dump stat because there's no benefit to it.
Sure.
But in the initial game, the expectation is even for average charisma, you should probably have like four. You should have four henchmen, or up to 6 or 12, and you know, possibly, you know, be multiplying your party numbers by up to 6.
Right. It's certainly something I've come across in my games. When I do introduce henchmen, I often have to remind players, like, I need you guys to tell me who's their boss. Like, who do they directly report to? Because that's the person whose charisma modifier I'm going to be using on any kind of morale checks.
Yes, yes. So particularly nowadays, there's a lot of that kind of stuff. If we have to really take an extra step to remind players what the mechanics are like, because they kind of don't expect that.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you play, how widely used do your players actually use henchmen?
Generally, a fair amount, I would say. A fair amount. So I'm trying to let me think about this. So it probably depends on how many people are at the table, right?
Okay.
So when it's a big group, they want to use henchmen less just because it's, you know, more turns per round that bog things down.
Right.
So oftentimes they're looking at henchmen for a couple of use cases. They're looking at henchmen for either like to fill in a gap, right? We don't have a person who can do X. Or they're looking for just a meat shield of we need somebody that we're going to sucker into opening the doors because we don't want to get hit with the traps.
Yep.
So those are the usual use cases for them. And then my game has sort of evolved a third use case, which I'll bring up later, but it wasn't really player originating. Let me say that.
Okay. Interesting. So one of the things that, like, actually, one of the main times I remember that my current players went out to hire multiple henchmen was they found a big batch of ghouls, and they almost got TPK'd by this batch of ghouls. And so on the return trip, their plan was, we will hire a bunch of elves specifically.
Interesting.
And our front meat shield will be a bunch of elves so that they can't be paralyzed, at least.
Nope. My players have sometimes drawn a distinction, and it's funny that you mentioned that there's different names for this of hirelings and then eventually henchmen. And I feel like my players have sort of evolved a distinction between these two things, that a hireling is a sort of non-combat person who does menial tasks but isn't really involved in the adventure part of the adventure. So that can be anything from like the guy who carries your torches to the guards you leave behind to guard your horses, or anything where, like, we're not really going to worry about where they are in the round-to-round of combats. And they tend to use henchmen as, like, this is almost a party member. This is a person who comes with us and does the adventure stuff and is going to get some XP out of it. I don't know where we picked that up or how that evolved.
I think that's totally, like, advanced D&D terminology.
Okay.
So I think that's 100% accurate to advanced D&D terminology, in which only the charisma only affects the henchmen, and you can just hire as many hirelings as you want without limit.
Right.
Is that how you play that?
I don't think so. I honestly, I've never. So here's the question, right? Like, if my charisma says I can have 3 hirelings, and your charisma says you can have 8 hirelings, those are not values on the chart, but whatever. Can the party have a total of 11 hirelings?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in which case, we've never hit those limits. Generally, the number of people my party wants to hire is well below those caps.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's never
understood. And I feel like, again, that kind of, reminds us of the early Blackmoor games where every player had their own kind of mini team, possibly in competition with each other, I think is part of where that sensibility comes from. So I'm not surprised that you don't have parties that don't have number of players times 6 total henchmen.
The total henchmen value on the party scale can get quite large, right?
Right.
So, have you hit it?
Not the opposite.
Yeah.
we're usually at about 0.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. So I have some other totally separate cases that have come up organically that I can talk about in regards to how my party has used henchmen. Part of that is, like I said, it sort of starts with a rule that I initiated and then kind of grew in this weird organic way. I'd love to tell you about it, but I don't want to take you off your track here of what you're talking about.
You know, tell it now. Now I'm curious. What
is that? Okay. So I used, in the beginning, my players really wanted to know what the rules were around henchmen, especially in regards to experience points, because that's what really affects them, right? So they want to know how much experience points are these guys going to soak from us? And so I made it pretty clear, okay, if you have a henchman, somebody who's coming along with you and is actually like partaking in the adventure, they're going to get a half share of XP, which I think is pretty standard.
Absolutely. That was first explicated in the first supplement, Greyhawk. That's in every single rule set, exactly like that.
Okay, great. So there you go. Definitely going to get half XP. And then they wanted to sort of know, like, well, how far can we push the envelope in terms of sort of like bossing them around? Are they mindless slaves, or are you going to role play them? How's that going to work? And so I said, well, they're going to behave in a reasonable way, and I may occasionally have to make a check against your charisma to see if they're going to follow your orders if your orders are insane.
Yeah.
But generally, they'll more or less do what you tell them to do if it's a reasonable request. And so we were all on board on all those counts. And then we started to have to deal with the problem of what do we do with a player character when that player is absent, right? Which is a problem I think every group has got to figure out in some way. Yeah. I played with a lot of things, ideas of like, oh, we'll leave them behind and then they have to catch up, or, you know, like a lot of the options around now I have to come up with fiction as to why their character is missing and fiction as to why they suddenly reappear, which we all decided was onerous. And so I said, okay, any player who's not present, their character becomes a henchman for the session.
Okay.
Full henchman rules apply. They start deferring to someone, they get half XP, but their neck is still on the line. Your character could still die because you're not here and somebody gives them some order that seems reasonable and you do it.
Interesting.
It works pretty darn well, it turns out, because the players like that. They like that their character still gets some XP when they're absent, which is kind of cool, but they realize there's a risk there to their character, that which is a little uncomfortable, maybe encourages them to not miss sessions, which is nice. So that rule came up. And then here's where it gets weird. When I first started my longest running campaign, we had a player who rolled up a character that we called Blood Mallet, or his name was Blood Mallet, that's the name he came up with, because he rolled a natural 18 for his strength. Yep. And he decided, I'm going to make this character your sort of classic, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger dumb barbarian, right? Here's your Conan-esque, but more kind of like dim, right?
Right.
So prototypical barbarian that most people, like, I don't have to say much more words than that. Prototypical barbarian, and everyone certainly knows what he is.
Yeah.
And then that player completely flaked out and stopped coming to the game. So, like, he came to one or two sessions and then was gone. And then we played this campaign for years afterwards. So his character, in the beginning, became a henchman, right? And so he continued to be the party henchman for a while. And then eventually he became the loner character. If somebody's friend was in from out of town or somebody wanted to, like, just sit in for a session, we said, great, you can play Blood Mallet.
Yeah, that's
so
nice.
Blood Mallet evolved into this weird, he's the party's henchman, but we can loan him out, and it's super easy for people to pick him up because everyone, dumb barbarian, here you go. And they go, okay, I know how to play this character. And the hilarious thing is, of all the characters in our party, I think Blood Mallet perhaps had the most personality. He was constantly being, he was sort of group made, right? He was constantly being contributed to by the regular players as well as by special guests. And everyone remembers him really fondly. He's like a favorite character from the game. And I think that's, for me, I've seen that consistently, Blood Mallet aside, I've seen that consistently for a lot of henchmen characters, that they become kind of beloved by the party and they get really interesting personalities because they're created by committee rather than by a single person.
I like that. That's a really interesting take. And, you know, we have an example of that when we had our third edition game, because the character that I was running gained the henchman Windstick, who was a half-orc monk that somebody else made up, which is to me, like a really crazy race combination. And then, I think they stopped coming or something like that.
Yep.
So I inherited this character that, to me, was totally bizarre combination of personality, race, and class, an orc. A lawful orc monk, and I took him on as my henchman that was very much in contrast to my main character. and had them running together for a very long amount of time. And you're right, it was a combination I never would have come up with on my own.
Didn't we also see the same thing with Red Wexler? Yep.
Yes.
tell us about Red Wexler, Dan.
He was like a non-class like boatman,
yeah,
right?
He was zero level human.
He was like a zero level, like, I don't know, pirate henchman, just ran a boat.
Yep.
And so a guy with, like, you know, did he have a peg leg? Was that part of it?
I don't think to start, but maybe he eventually did. Didn't he also have a drinking problem? I want to think he had a drinking problem.
Very much so. So for some reason, this zero level boatman was just hanging around with us permanently, and we all got a chance to, like, give voice to what surly, salty thing Observation Red had.
Yeah, I think maybe we invented the drinking problem just to explain why he routinely submitted himself to the mad things we made him do. It's like, well, he's drunk.
That's a really good case. So let me talk about, so the downside, that's a really interesting, it's interesting that you have the PCs become henchmen. I got to admit, I do it the opposite, is if a player doesn't show up, they are nowhere to be found.
Yeah. It's a problem I've wrestled with regularly, right? What do you do when a player's absent? We could probably do a whole talk on that. But the other funny one I came up with is at some point I gave the whole party a chronic disease. So they all contracted this chronic disease, which occasionally came up. So every now and then someone would double over and be like, oh, he's not feeling good today. The disease has kicked back up. He's spending a lot of time squatted over a bowl. And, you know, he's just not helpful. You guys kind of drag him along.
Were you making rolls for that? Or was that just...
No, that was just... That's how we explained, like, well, this person's still technically here.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The character's here, but they're totally useless.
Okay.
Because they're suffering from the crutz today.
Okay. All right.
Oh, my crutz has acted up again. Oh, jeez.
Specific solution to that problem.
So is it not a problem you've had to solve? I feel like it's a big problem that's regularly.
The end of every session, they have to be back in town. Mm-hmm. And then the start of every session, whoever gets on the team is whoever the players were there.
I mean, that's another interesting solution. Yeah. That's sort of like you have to go back to this common point.
Yep.
That's a neat one. I find that doesn't always work, right? That's sometimes like, oh, you're looking at your watch and you're like, there's no way they're getting back to town.
I think the only time it hasn't worked for me is if they're in the wilderness.
Yeah.
If they're in the distant wilderness, that was the one time that didn't work out. The players know that they have to get back to town, and we leave a little bit of time for that. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I do force that every single time.
Interesting. Yep, yeah. It's a solution I've tried as well in the past. I've had less success with it because the players, they're just greedy. They just want to get as much done as possible. And so they run me up to the clock, and then I either have to do some weird Deus Ex Machina thing or something, and it just never felt good.
Interesting.
But the henchman one. I think it's a pretty good solution. I've used it for a while. Like I said, it has the added benefit of kind of encouraging the players to show up, right? If you're group has that one character, that one player who's a little flaky. Here's real repercussions to that flakiness.
Have you actually had one of them perish with the player out of session?
Let me think about that. I feel like not, and I don't think it did, and I think that's because the players ultimately came to this sort of agreement with each other, this sort of social contract that they invented for each other of, like, we're not going to push your character into the danger zone because I recognize I might be next.
Okay.
Right. I might be out next weekend and then I'm screwed. So they generally were pretty respectful to the person who's out and only used them for light stuff and tried to protect them and keep them behind. Behind walls and whatnot.
Interesting.
Even to the point where, like, sometimes they'd be like, you know, if the wizard was out, unless they really needed his spells, like, hey, you go hide behind that rock while we fight these orcs.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. So in my campaign, the players will not use henchmen.
Interesting.
They hired two for this ghoul situation, and they had and they have one remaining out of that, and I would keep reminding them of the possibility of hiring more henchmen, and I have had to come around to the fact and just accept that my players that are mostly new to original D&D in the last couple of years, they just don't want that. And the downside, and I think I've come to accept why. There are legitimate reasons why, and I think it's an interesting fresh perspective. So there's at least three disadvantages of henchmen. One, I think that people come to the table expecting to role play an individual character. And the idea of spreading themselves mentally out among multiple characters to run them is not what they expect nowadays from a role-playing game. They expect one character, and they're going to inhabit it, and they kind of don't want to lose that.
Does that mean you're actually, when someone has a henchman at your table, you're like giving them complete control as if they were that player's second character?
You know, I am.
Okay, basically. That's interesting. It's a little different from the way I play it. I generally... I try to reinforce that he's your minion attitude, where like I role play the henchman, you give me commands, and I tell you what happens. I will still sometimes then even say delegate, like you have to roll his attacks for him.
Yeah.
Right. But I still like generally I voice him. Generally I roll things like morale checks and whatnot.
And right.
Although ultimately the players, you know, usually if the henchman has a lot of personality, they can't help themselves, and they give a couple lines in the henchman voice, and that's fine.
Right. I would say that I give the play. See, this is actually one of the things I wanted to ask about. Yeah. Actually, I give them like 85% control. I give them the sheet. They just run them in combat. I might roll a morale check, and I keep the alignment hidden.
Interesting. So I would even go so far as to. So I have their stats hidden, right? Like, yeah. I don't just give them the henchman's character sheet. I have that behind the screen.
Okay.
I put them last in the initiative order. Henchmen always go last.
I've
gone so far as to roll all the rolls for the henchmen, and then sometimes I'm bad at that, and I forget to do it, and the players call me out, and then I just say, okay, well, you roll for them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, you see, that's why I give them, is I feel like that's a burden that I kind of don't want to take on. So, like, I feel like I'm running enough stuff already.
I agree with that, but I don't want the player to feel like they have this amazing new power of a whole second character that they have complete control over, who will do things that are maybe not in the interest of that character because they're being controlled by this person, right? Like, somehow, I hate when you end up with a henchman who's just so subservient to their master.
Yeah.
You know, unless magic's involved and whatever, great. Let's make a completely ensorcelled, subservient guy. Sure. That's great. But generally, like, if you're just paying them to be there, I feel like the player needs some disinterested party, such as the GM, to check them on what they're asking the henchmen to do.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I am making it's in the book. I'm making loyalty checks, right? Mm-hmm. So anytime they say you go through the door first, loyalty check.
Yep.
If they say pick up and test this dangerous magic item, loyalty check, and almost all the time they refuse.
So they're still, I guess, the way the player controls the henchmen, it sounds to me like in your game, they're still saying, I order so-and-so to go through the door, not so-and-so goes through the door.
Well, practically it's the former. Sometimes the player might forget and say, she goes through the door, and then I go, well, I'm making a loyalty check for that.
Right.
But yeah, for practical purposes, they're making orders, and it may or may not.
Okay, well, I think if your players can do that, that's great.
Yeah,
I've definitely had cases where the player just tries to take over the henchman, and it's their second character, so they talk about both characters in the first person voice, and I'm like, now we're losing track of the fact that this is actually someone else who's not you.
Gotcha. For me, I mean, they have the sheet. They can put them anywhere in the marching order. They come up in the order at the same time as that player. But for particularly on you, like for you're doing something solo, then a loyalty check comes into play to possibly prevent that.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. So, has the topic of Rose come up? I'm looking forward to our game in July, which we're going to livecast. Everyone's going to livecast a game over the 4th of July weekend. Check it out.
Yeah, And Paul will be running it, and I will be playing it with, along with other people.
Excellent. And it's a continuation of the game we played last year, and we'll do our best to catch everyone up to what's going on. It's not that complicated, don't worry. But
there's a dungeon, and we're getting treasure out of it.
Yeah. The party did hire a henchman named Rose in that game. Yeah. And I think that a lot of the players in that game are your players, right?
Correct. Yes, correct.
So have you ever said, oh, interesting, you guys don't want henchmen like Rose?
Well, that's an interesting case.
It was probably you that pushed them into hiring Rose in the first place. For everyone's enlightenment, the party, they decided it would be funny to all be elves. And I think there was some reason you needed a dwarf. I don't remember what it was. And so you decided to hire a dwarf, and her name was Rose.
Trap fighting or something,
yeah. Yeah, something like that. And she saved everyone's life. It was her dwarven saving throw bonus that prevented her from being enabled her to be the only party member who did not succumb to the Siren Song of a Harpy.
Yeah.
And she saved everyone.
Right. That's a good point. I mean, that's actually a good example, actually, of me being more pro henchman than all my players, actually. The big ticket item is as you said, Paul, the henchman traditionally gets half of a share of XP and also gets some treasure.
Yep.
Right.
So
every reference to henchmen is they got to get paid. They should have a share of the treasure. In AD&D, at the back of the player's book, there's a suggestion that they should get maybe a fraction in ratio of their level, maybe.
Interesting.
And my players hate that. Hmm. My players hate losing XP and losing treasure.
Interesting.
To the henchmen. It's like a third rail anathema to them.
Huh.
And so the main thing that when that comes up is they're like, we don't want to lose XP and we don't want to lose treasure to one or more henchmen.
Now I have allowed my party, I do think of those two things as pretty separate, in as much as XP is such a game mechanic that I just enforce it. I say, if there's a henchman, they get half XP. That's how it goes.
Yep.
Whereas with how much money you pay them, I let the players negotiate that in character.
Yep. It 100% the same. That happened. They, I think when they were hiring henchmen the first time, there were a couple of negotiations that the prospect said no to, and the one henchman that they have, they are perpetually unhappy at the deal that they negotiated, and every single time treasure gets split up, they all go, "We got screwed by this enormously high amount of treasure, which is still less than a player character that we're giving the henchmen. It burns them every single session how much they got.
That I've seen. And usually usually my players don't agree on it. So some players are like, are you kidding? It's worth every penny. And other players are like, you idiots, we're losing treasure. But then also I see the inverse where they're underpaying their henchmen. They all recognize we're underpaying our henchmen. And the henchman does something cool. And, it's bonus time, man. They just oh, you did something amazing and wonderful. You deserve a bonus. Here you go.
Okay. Yeah. I can see that. Yeah, my for what it's worth, my particular party of players are basically all in agreement. However that conversation occurred, are all in agreement that both the XP and the treasure hit are unacceptably high.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I suppose it's just a thing that does vary from group to group, right?
And I will say there's a side point to that is that, as you said right at the beginning of this discussion, there's one there's supposed to be one chief leader character per henchman that ties into that charisma rule, but the XP and the treasure are coming out of the entire party share, so there's a little bit of a one player has decided to get a henchman. And they're magically taking a slice out of the whole party for their own personal benefit issue. That's kind of a side issue, but I think that's something that someone can possibly be aggrieved about.
I mean, the whole, how do you split treasure is an interesting topic, right? That is something that, as GM, I always leave to my players. I say, that's between you guys. I have nothing to do with that. Here's money. You guys figure it out.
How does that work for you? Does that work well?
Sure. Yeah. Ooh. And I've had the groups always come up with their own solutions. And sometimes they renegotiate with each other because they realize they didn't like their solutions.
Okay.
I had one group that I thought of as highly communist because they would take very little personally and they loved keeping a party fund. There was always a separate fund that most of the treasure went into, and it was all for the party. And even to the point of, like, I think maybe a couple of the players maybe were starting to get grumpy about it, about, like, you know, oh, that magic items are always being handed out to exactly who needs them, and, like, I feel like I, you know, all my self-interest is gone.
Okay.
Because we're like, collectively running a group of adventurers rather than individually playing interesting characters. I don't think they ever voiced it exactly that way, but that's my interpretation of what they were trying to say. Typically now my current group that I play with, and just, again, I don't have a current campaign, but I'm just thinking of the same, I generally the same folks who are around here who play, oftentimes they like to have a party share. So they say, oh, there's five of us, so we're going to split all treasure six ways, and one share goes into the party kitty, which is for emergencies, for party use, like, oh God, we need to pay for a resurrection or whatever.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that happens a lot in my groups.
Admittedly, I think I've been in a situation where I just didn't want to deal with the I've had at least one experience in a different game recently whereby the open table negotiations turn into a train wreck. not with my regular campaign. So I actually have just been arbitrarily taking the treasure and just doing a division saying you all get this and just not even getting into the discussion about it. And that having been said, the party is very supportive. So as soon as someone's out of money, someone else pops up and says, I'll just spot you for whatever.
Yep. Yep. I mean, I think it comes down to, like, how much trust is at the table, right? Yep. But if the group is new and they're not used to playing with each other, or you're playing at a convention game, but then, like, why do they even care about treasure at that point? But whatever it is, then oftentimes, like, just having a heart, this is the rule of the table, deal with it, is probably better.
Yeah.
Whereas if the players really trust each other, I'd like to give them the leeway to say that maybe you've got one player who's playing a thief who's going to be greedy and going to try and pocket extra. And the other players are okay with that. Right. Like, yeah. On a player level, we're OK that your character is greedy and my character is naive or doesn't notice. And you end up with more stuff. And that's funny to all of us at the table as players.
Right.
But then there are certainly certain player types who are, like, just going to get bent out of shape over that kind of stuff. And so you just want to say, nope, not happening. Not at this table.
What you're doing is very much more traditional. It's very much more in the book. The back of the Advanced Players book totally says, here's some different ways that you might decide to chop up treasure, A, B, C, D, E, F, right? And so what you're doing is actually more by the book than what I'm doing. And I guess I'm gun shy nowadays about getting into that, negotiation, actually.
It's interesting. Yeah. I think it totally depends on your players, I think. You gotta read your players and know what's going to work for them and make them play nice with each other and not strangle each other, right?
Right. And I'm sure my players would handle that perfectly fine, but I'm just in the habit of, like, I myself don't want to get in the habit and then have different people have a problem with that.
Yeah.
And we've both seen the rare situation where someone is either aggrieved or pushing it too far. So,
Yep.
So I have a little bit of scar tissue over that issue.
We have so tangented far, far away from henchmen.
Good point. Good point. Henchmen. Anyway, yeah. I have personally become comfortable with my players not hiring henchmen.
It's their choice, right?
That has stopped becoming part of the game, and they have legitimate reason why. And that's basically no longer part of our game, more or less.
And do you have moments where it's Dan talking to player where you go, you guys are idiots. Why aren't you?
Absolutely, 100% not. No way, no how. And I honestly do, in fact, they're actually not idiots about it. They actually have legitimately good justifications for that.
Okay, it's fair.
And I accept it. I'm happy to get to share a different perspective than what I personally started with.
Yeah.
You know, like me personally, I like running lots of characters, right? That's a little bit of my DM aspect, is I'm accustomed to running 1, 2, 5, 10, 20, 40, 100 people is my normal thing. So as you've seen when I play, like I want henchmen, I want multiple voices. And it has it's good for me to get somebody else's perspective, but not everybody wants that.
Yeah, I think it comes down to like how much separation do you have between player and character, like, and how comfortable are you as a player jumping between those? Right, like a lot of times, I feel like D&D is playing with this immersive quality where you really want the player to imagine what it's like to be in this situation, and that's hard to do when you're like, "Well, I'm two people,"
right.
And not impossible, hard, right? So I think better role players are like, "Yeah, I wanna argue with myself because I'm a lunatic." Right.
And then even when you do that, you know, when I do that, I have to think, make sure that I'm not taking up too much time because if I start having like a self dialogue. I don't want to, I certainly don't want to take up too much time at the table and detract from other people's time in the spotlight.
Now, I remember a time when you came up for my birthday and you ran Rappanathic for this the first time, and we decided it would be very amusing for us all to play human wizards so we could all have warrior henchmen. So, a little side perk. That, I don't know, do you still give this side perk? A perk that Dan used to give for playing a human was you get a free henchman. Is that still on the books?
I actually kind of don't. I've sort of erased that. Partly to the experience of seeing people don't all want that. I actually have kind of erased that.
Interesting. I like to use that myself these days, so I totally lifted that from you. Although generally what I tell them is they get a servant of some kind. Somebody who's not really a combatant, not a full henchman, but a porter or an apprentice or somebody, some young person who they can order about, who's going to do their bidding, but isn't really going to be much help in dungeon, round-to-round combat or dungeon exploration.
Okay, interesting. And just humans, you're saying, get that
bonus? Just humans. Yeah, just a thing to give humans something else, because generally, I think everybody correctly identifies that the demi-humans get all the cool stuff.
Right, right. Particularly in convention tournament play, when the level caps are obviously not actually going to come into play, that's where that's how that started for me, is I felt like there had to be some kind of trade-off in those situations.
Yep. So I had a player in my campaign who hired a scroll boy, specifically because he had lost one of his arms. And so he's playing a wizard, and he's got this big collection of scrolls, and at any moment in the combat, he might need to pull out the scroll, unfurl it, and read it. And we all had a lot of trouble visioning how that works with one arm. So he hired a young lad to carry his scrolls, and he would say, "Scroll number 3," and the kid would run around in front of him and roll it up, and then he would hold the scroll out so he could read it.
Wow!
And it was hilarious.
that's great. You know, for what it's worth, I mean, at the moment, I have a rule on my book that the zero level non-henchmen refuse to go into dungeons.
Okay.
So for what it's worth, I actually, my personal house rule now is a torch boy or a porter or something like that will just not go into a dangerous dungeon. It's got to be one of the specialized combat types.
So why is that?
Because the cost differential, it's expensive to get a henchman who can fight. The porter and the or whatever is so relatively incredibly cheap that I feel like if you're not paying them enough to be a body in a combat, possibly.
Right. I mean, that sounds like you mean you're allowing them to actually fight.
Well, even even just be like a target, be like a target for a round. I don't think the expense is even worth sucking up one random attack, even if they don't get any attacks themselves. I guess that brings up a fourth reason why my players don't want to hire henchmen, is because as they advance in levels, the prospect of them hiring a first level character, they're all like, well, they're just going to get murdered instantly at this point.
Yep.
So there's even a fourth reason why they don't want to bother with it.
I'm happy to have them bring the moron into the dungeon with them, and I delight in killing that character. So Exit Sanity is posted to our chat here. There's the emotional cost of losing a Lantern Boy in the dungeon, which totally happened to him. In fact, I think their whole party left the Lantern Boy behind. He was holding the lantern, and he just was on the wrong side of an obstacle, and they said, sorry, we have to go. And there was a lot of emotional drama around that. It was actually quite fun. And I enjoyed leaving little hints for them of what became of Dennis the Lantern Boy, who was left behind.
And the other way around on that, great example. There is a detriment to my current don't allow that, actually. It was totally a detriment. And the flip side of that is we had a convention game a couple years ago in which the party, and I was running it, the party hired a Lantern Boy. Mm-hmm. Our friend Steve had a fighter, right, and got immediately murdered in the first room. And so Steve took over the zero-level Lantern Boy, picked up a weapon, started fighting, and just kept rolling 20s.
That's amazing.
Just kept rolling 20s time and time again when the party was up against the ropes, and the Lantern Boy became the hero of the session.
Yep.
Right. The Lantern Boy became the big hero, and like I feel clearly he's now first level, and he's clearly a fighter, and he actually, just due to brutal random luck, became the most powerful fighter in that game.
That's great. That's great. I love stuff like that. I would totally rule that exactly the same way. You know, sure, okay, maybe you can try to hit something, and if you really managed to pull it off, then sure, let's convert you up to a level one character. That's great.
Right. And actually, of course, that character had so much more voice and personality than anything else due to that crazy series of circumstances.
You know, that brings up another point for me is I also point out to my players that a henchman is sort of a way for them to bank some of their XP, in as much as when a player dies, I give them the option of roll a new first level character or take over the henchman.
Yeah, that's one of the best things I've heard, right? That's one of the best things I've heard, and a great, great observation. And
So that's an interesting. I might even bring that up to your players, or I could bring that up to your players as a hey, here's a thing you guys aren't thinking of. That way, like, it's not really lost XP, right? You're not losing a half share of XP. You're saving it for a rainy day.
That's great. I mean, bring it up at the next session.
I will mention that. And it's easy to mention that, I think, as a blanket rule. As DM, I just want you guys to know, if you die, here are the rules. Number one, you can choose to make a first level character. Number two, if there is a henchman in the group, you may take over that playing that henchman.
Now, the benefit that I give that's in the other direction that might possibly soften that argument is original D&D has this inheritance rule.
Mm-hmm.
And
I lost you, Dan. You've frozen up. Oh no, it's just me. Dan has been a whole person spell has taken over Dan, unfortunately. Oh, thank goodness you're back.
Oh jeez.
You failed your save and were held for moments.
I of course was watching that whole thing and oh my god, that was the best riff I've on this show to date. That was freaking incredible.
I'm glad I didn't have to keep it going too long.
That was amazing. So original D&D has an inheritance rule, right? And the earliest player character sheets actually had a will as the last thing on the character sheet was a critical essential thing. So I actually am now in the position whereby if a character dies, you make up a low level character, but you get all the material stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You get all the material stuff inherited as a relative of the old character.
And when you say they make a new low level character, is it literally zero XP level one or are you giving them a boost?
I'm starting everybody at two.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's not a huge jump.
Right.
I want to point out, before we run out of time, I had mentioned earlier that when we played Rappanathic, that we played all wizards with warrior henchmen because we thought it was brilliant. I think there was four of us, and we thought, this is a great way to beef up our party. It was a terrible idea, as I recall. We were all playing fourth-level wizards. We all got first-level warriors, and it turns out that those first-level warriors were not prepared for what we encountered and just got smushed quickly. Yeah.
When I very vividly remember the table in your dining room rolling up characters and thinking, should I just veto this? Should I just veto this whole thing?
No, let us make our own mistakes.
One of those horrible roller coastery gut checks as DM of like, Seth, oh God, am I? Anyway, it was an interesting experience.
Great. Exit Sanity wants to know why you start players at level 2. And me too. I want to know that too.
Okay. Okay. So at the great question. First level might be too frail. First level might be too frail to get new players into. I will defend this by saying that at the in his later life, Gygax was playing all of his games starting people at level 3.
Interesting.
And I do feel like 3 is kind of the magic number as far as you have a little bit of durability, you can take a hit, decide to run away. So there's, you know, wizards are not going to have just one spell.
What level is your party, your general party at this point? Like, what's the average? Like
4 or 5.
I feel like you're going to feel like that gap is going to keep increasing, right? Like, when they're at 9th level, you'll be like, 2 is so low.
Yeah.
I used to do that. I used to start them at higher level. Maybe even, I think there was a time where I just did current average party level -1 or lowest current party member level -1.
You and I have both, I mean, back when we were playing 3rd edition, you and I went around this issue many, 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 many times with many formulas.
My favorite now is level 1, suck it up, buttercup.
Yeah, yeah. And I will say that you know, I started everybody at level 2, so when we started the game, everybody came in at level 2.
Oh, that's interesting. So they've never even seen level 1.
Correct. That is correct, except for henchmen.
Okay.
But for my current game, just the floor is level 2. And I would expect as they go higher in level, if somebody needs to restart, they would start at level 2. I'm not modifying that.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. I you know, honestly, I would actually tend to start people at level 3. But the reason I don't start at level 3 is when you bump up to level 4, now you have feats.
Yep.
And I don't want people to get the impression you get a feat every time you level up.
Okay.
So that's actually the reason I put them at 2 instead of 3.
My argument for level 1 is when a level 1 character is roaming around with a overpowered party, yeah, they may have to sort of stand in the back for a couple of fights, but it's not going to take very long. They're going to jump levels very quickly.
I totally agree. I 100% agree. I think I'm comfortable with that. I think it's not any worse than the complicated formula stuff that we wrestled with.
Yep.
We've had at least one friend who argued very vociferously against that he really hated that.
That hated starting at level 1?
Yeah, really hated having to play it safe for a session or 2 or 3.
Gotcha.
In order to level up.
Yep, I could see it. It's a fair argument.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no, I mean, we've thought very, you and I have both thought very, very deeply about that. And in going on 20 years, there's clearly no silver bullet to that particular issue. But I think going down to the bottom level is there's nothing better than that we've discovered.
Yeah, I think it's fine. I think that the geometric progression of XP in the charts compensates.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, if you had henchmen, right? If you had henchmen and they were a level or two behind you, and you could just swap off the henchmen, that would be a great solution to that.
Yep.
But
it's a good reason for why to bring a henchman.
Yeah. Yeah, but if you're going to say no to henchmen, you're going to have to accept that you're just going to drop back to the floor. Yep.
All right, so it seems like we're running a little long here. I want to wrap us up. Any final thoughts on henchmen, Dan?
I've had to make a big adjustment for my players. I am coming from a place where I'm used to having big numbers of people. That's what I see in the original D&D rules. It was an essential part when it started out, and my players have basically said no to that. They have reasonable justification. It's a really interesting adjustment that I've had to make for that.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I guess you do what works for your party.
Yeah.
I will just point out to everyone that on my blog, paulsgameblog.com, I do have a tool that is an OED character generator. I use this at the table. When the party does say we want to go hire henchmen, I go, great, I press the button. I got 10 henchmen to choose from. I enjoy doing that. But yeah, I would say it's useful to have some stats up or easily grabbable when the party suddenly decides we want to hire someone and you're not quite ready for that.
It's a great tool. I highly recommend that. I likewise keep a list of henchmen if my players decide to go in the other direction, go hire somebody. I also have a stack of henchmen ready to go if need be.
Cool. And yeah. If you come in and tune in and watch us live play over the 4th of July weekend, you'll see some henchmen use in action.
With interesting unexpected consequences, I'm sure.
Great. So I think that about wraps us up. If you have any thoughts about how you have used henchmen in the past or reactions to any of the odd stories of what we've done, please post them in the comments. Let us know. Or if you feel like there's an area of henchmen that we haven't touched and it's a big topic and I won't be surprised. So leave us a note and maybe we'll have a henchmen 2 conversation in the future.
Yeah, and as always, please subscribe to our Wandering DMs channel on YouTube. That does help us out a lot. We plan to be live every other Sunday at 1 p.m., so our next live cast should be, I believe, Sunday, June the 9th would be our plan. So please come back on June the 9th and join us for another thought-provoking discussion here on Wandering DMs, and we'll see you next time.
We'll see you then.